So welcome to the Playbook podcast. I'm Pankaj Mishra, and I'm really excited to be sitting down with a familiar face over years. I must say, who's been building the startup very quietly, except the times when we met.
Social gatherings, maybe not so quiet.
So I'm sitting down with Vinod Muthukrishnan, who is the founder of CloudCherry. A startup which has been in news more recently because it got acquired by Cisco. And, you know, while that's the news, you know, one of the things we have always believed is, you know, to get under the hood and understand the building blocks of, you know, startup journey. Mm-hmm. And that is why I'm sitting down with you.
Awesome.
Thanks for joining us in this conversation.
Awesome. Very happy to be here. And always admired the work you've done at Factorially before your entire career. And obviously, it's no secret that anyone who knows you has the highest regard for you. So I think it's my privilege to be on your show.
Yeah, no, you're being very kind, Vinod. Vinod, let's start from the start. Give us a sense of who you are, where you come from, and then we will get into the building blocks of
culture. Absolutely. So my antecedents are a strong giveaway to who I am. So my father was in the army. He's a gallantry award winner. We are South Indians, of course, but Hindi speaking South Indians, you know, because we lived all over the country. My brother joined the Navy, hardly a surprise. I joined the Merchant Navy. So father was in the army, brother was in the Navy. I almost joined the National Defense Academy. And then, you know, I decided to join the Merchant Navy because I wanted to see the world. And then we all assume that someone has to go abroad to make money in the family. So I joined the Merchant Navy. Obviously, great army upbringing, right? I know it's a hot topic these days, but even though we born to very spiritual, religious parents, we generally didn't understand even difference between religions at home. That's how we were brought up, right? We went to every place of worship, enjoyed every experience, never had too much money, but I think probably had the most fulfilling childhood any parent can give their child, right? So going out to the world was a great experience for me. A very tight-knit family, of course. And I spent 9 years in the Merchant Navy itself, which was incredible. I love going across the world, all the diverse experiences that it brings, you know, work with different people. And the one lesson I learned in the Merchant Navy, which has held true even now, is the will of 15 or 16 people can do anything. Because on ship, a 300-meter long ship may have a crew of 14, 15, 16 people working round the clock, you know, 24 hours a day. Ship doesn't stop. And yet that group of men and women can do impossible things, right? So that's an incredible experience for me. And in 2006, I was on leave and a friend of mine had just started his own startup. And just for you to know, I did not know what a startup meant. Because when I was on ship, there was no internet. So every time I'd come back after 6, 8, 9 months, I won't even be able to recognize the lingo that people are using because I was that far behind what was colloquial, what was, you know, commonplace. So he told me what he was doing. I loved the idea. You know, at the start of every startup, every revenue projection goes to $1 billion. So I said, yeah, ye to bahut aasan hai. We should be doing this too. Then he said, why don't you join us? So he wanted me to join as business strategist in the core founding team of that startup. Which was a fintech startup. So I neither knew finance, nor technology, nor business, nor strategy. So every building block I didn't know. But he said, give it 3 months. You have 3 months of leave. If it doesn't work out, go back on ship. If you like it, continue. So purely to kill 3 months of leave, I joined that startup and ended up spending 7 years there. I led global sales. We closed great, huge deals globally. But I think in India, I'm most proud that we were the first mobile stock trading platform. The National Stock Exchange of India's mobile trading platform is ours. It's a company called Market Simplified. The NSE is an investor in the company. In fact, I know you had featured Mr. Uday Kotak. So the Kotak M-Banking app, 811, everything is done by us. So I thought that in many ways, we were fintech, early days in fintech. And after 7 years there, 7 complete years there, I wanted to do something my own. And we'll come to how the company started, but that is when the origin of CloudCherry happened. So that's my journey. Always happy to take whatever opportunity comes my way, you know. And I'd rather do something and be proven wrong than know that I'm probably likely to fail and hence not embark in that quest at all. So that's a quick insight into me.
you have clearly been battle ready in that sense. Now let's come to Cloud Cherry itself, right? Take us through the building blocks from idea to the time when you thought it can actually become a startup, a company. Mm. And then we can pick some of the key milestones internally or externally and focus on the key learning.
Excellent. So 7 years in a startup taught me one great thing. Venkat, who's the CEO of Markets and Pride, my very close friend, taught me what a great startup founder looks like, right? So great respect for him. But a great startup founder also makes sure he insulates the rest of his team from the pressures of fundraising and all those things. So even though I'd spent 7 years in a startup, I had no idea how to make a plan for a long-term sustainable startup, right? So armed with very little cash. So what happened was, when I quit Markets and Pride to do something my own, I went to my cousin, Professor Sriram, who was the founding team, the CEO of the Great Lakes Institute of Management in Chennai, right? So Sriram was my childhood hero when he was at SPJ and always looked up to him. And I asked him, should I do an exec MBA to broaden my horizons? So I didn't leave Markets and Pride to actually start a startup. I wanted to do something different. So as we were discussing whether I should do an MBA and, you know, broaden my horizons, the idea of Cloud Cherry, it's a long story, but the idea of Cloud Cherry came up for discussion, right? And then we all looked around the table and we met Vijay, who ended up being the co-founder of Cloud Cherry. We said this is worth a shot because the idea seemed great, simply because of one simple underlying reason. At that point in time, we were in 2013 when this conversation happened. And we could not name on our fingertips brands that we love so much that they will never lose our business. Right? So the problem of customer stickiness and loyalty was an unsolved problem. Right? A loyalty program doesn't mean a customer is loyal to you. Right? I had close to 1 million miles in Jet Airways. Right? I used up all of them. Of course, one of my favorite airlines ever. But when I stopped flying Jet, they didn't even probably know why I stopped flying them, right? They probably had no diagnostic of it, right? So we said that I know there may be many other softwares that are helping measure loyalty or CSAT or NPS or whatever. But the problem of truly understanding and driving customer stickiness and retention, we knew was an unsolved problem, right? So when this idea of Cloud Cherry came to us, we all unanimously agreed that software needs to solve this problem, right? And that is the problem we got out to solve. So obviously when we started, very little capital, we ran out of money in 4 months. And from the fourth month to the first anniversary, every month, true story, some friend would come visiting, saying, hey, what are you doing? I said, I'm running a startup and I'll sell them the vision. And without me asking, some friend or the other will say, hey, I love what you're doing, man, can I put in some money? Now, each of those friends, who thankfully today are making some money, funded the next month's pay cycle. This happened month after month after month. I think there are 6 or 7 friends who invested in the company in 2014, through 2014, who actually funded that month's payroll, you know, that month's vendor payments. We paid our vendors on time that day. We pay our vendors on time today, right? We said that if you can't pay a vendor, you should not be in business, right? So they paid for vendors, they paid for salaries, right? So the first year of the origin of the company was really that. Just some friend coming, giving money, pays the bills, and life goes on.
Yeah, that's a startup life.
That is startup life.
When did you see VC money? Excellent. How did it happen and why?
Yeah, no, good point.
Also, the other thing is also take you through the product building.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I did on day one when we wanted to start this company was I called upon Nagendra, who was the co-founder of Market Simplified. He and Venkat had hired me in Market Simplified. He had long since left, I think 3-4 years. In fact, 3 years before I left Market Simplified, he had gone to pursue his own thing. So on day one, I knew that a great company, tech company, can only be created when there's a great technologist at the heart of it. Right? So I knew on day one that if Nagendra were available, I hadn't been in touch with him for a couple of years, without him, this company or someone like him, this company wasn't buildable. Right? So I called him and asked him what he was doing. Thankfully, he wasn't fully involved in anything. You know, he was doing his own thing. And I asked him to be my co-founder in this venture. Right? So Nagendra came on board. One thing with Nagendra is that I don't think he's ever written what I would call intermediate code. Okay, let's code now, let's build something, and then we'll rewrite it later. He may build something small. Nagendra's code is perfection in the first pass, in the second, in the third. he may refactor, he may build on top, but I don't think he's ever written a line of code in his life which he knows will become obsolete in 6 months, right? He's an unbelievable, he coded 80% of the first platform. His code doesn't require QA, you know, he's that kind of a tech. He can architect, he can envision the business use case, he can write. So the first version of the product itself looked very world-class, right? It is not, let's build something, you know, time pass and we'll see if it scales. So by the middle of 2014, we had a product which you knew was superlative, which was world-class, right? What we didn't have was a GTM engine or capital.
GTM is...
Anyway, I mean, we were willing to sell to anybody. So we didn't even have an idea on where we wanted to sell, right? We didn't have the money, obviously, to dream big, right? And surely by account of the fact that you're paying each month's bill, your vision was India, right? You'd fly to Bombay or Delhi or Chennai or Bangalore and you'd sell to local business, right? So after a fair amount of time in 2014, we knew this was not sustainable, right? We needed outside capital. And Sridham connected us to the Chennai Angels. So when I went to pitch to Chennai Angels, I remember IDG, which is now Chirite, TCM was also there. And the incredible thing for us was, you know, there were, I think, 30 people in the room, right? So I pitched what I genuinely believed in. And just the natural body language and energy was so positive. We first got a customer there. So Ranjit, who runs DRA Constructions, it's a construction firm that says our motto is experience nice. Like, builders are not known to be nice. We are a nice homeowner, you know, buying experience. They still use, on their website, if you go even now, the customer delight score is published every month, right? So you had angel investors who believed in your vision, right? Who wanted to buy your product because they believed in it, hence also wanted to fund your company, right? So I met some incredible people there, you know, like Gopal Srinivasan of TVS, Lakshmi Narayan of Cognizant, Mithun Carrotlane. I remember Mithun came out to us after that session, say, hey, I'm Mithun, I'm the founder of Carrotlane. I'll be a liaison. You know, we like what you're doing. I met TCM from IDG. I met both of them that afternoon. And I loved the energy. They said, we like your company. We are going to invest. There were no games. Like, you know, they said, we like your company. We want to invest. Let's discuss terms this afternoon. So end of 2014, early 2015, I think it was somewhere towards the end of the year, we knew that, okay, this is at least mildly fundable. So we raised a small round. I think it was 750-800K. Somewhere that time I met Anish Reddy of Capillary. They invested some money. It became $1 million round basically, right? So we knew we had enough to build something out of, right? So around that time, we went out to a lot of Indian enterprises. Titan was one of our earliest customers. I know Puma also came pretty early. Capillary started taking out to some of their customers. So we knew, of course, we were still perfecting our delivery model, but we knew that there were people who wanted this product. I remember going to a very large bank wherein a lady who's right now a huge evangelist of CloudCherry, she said, look, we have many, many offers on the table for this measurement of customer experience. So I said, okay, let's forget about what we have. Can you draw for me in your mind what your ideal platform looks like? So she actually sketched out for me what it should have, what attributes. In a lot of prose, she told me what she wanted. I said, what if I demo the same thing to you in the next 15 minutes, a real breathing product? Interestingly enough, everything she asked for was in our platform.
Wow.
So that was HDFC Bank, right? So she saw it and said, this is exactly what I want. I think the head of marketing then, Karthik Jain, was there. And he looked at the platform and said, okay, this is exactly what we wanted. Like, if he had to close our eyes and sketch what our customer experience platform should look like, this is what it is. So we found early customers who liked what we did, you know, shared our vision, early investors who shared that. So that is how we got started with our initial set of customers. And of course, then life changed after that. But then we knew we had a business. People wanted our product. It solved a real problem. Even when someone hadn't seen our platform, what they sketched in their mind looked like the platform we'd created, you know. So we knew we had a real business. At this point in time, we were sure that this is something we can take globally.
Was there ever what they call valley of death, you know, which kind of happens maybe after you have raised a little funding, mm-hmm. and then you suddenly hit, you know, everything wrong starts happening,
yeah.
at different points in time. Did you ever face that valley of death kind of a thing?
So I have a saying which I'm assuming is original to me, okay, is that, you know, entrepreneurship is like, you know, historic highs and depressing lows, but sometimes on the same day before breakfast. So I don't think an early stage startup ever leaves the valley of death, because here you've just closed this humongous customer deal and you think you're going to be the next Google, you know what I'm saying? And like by breakfast, someone's called and told you that something went wrong, or, you know, something crashed, or some customer's not happy, or, you know, something's been done, has gone fundamentally wrong. So I generally believe, given that we are still a fairly early stage company, right? A lot of problems were existential. Capital was an existential problem. Your product scalability was an existential problem. Your customer stickiness was an existential problem. But I think we faced what I thought was a real, I wouldn't say value of debt, but a real existential question when we raised our Series A. We got great investors on board. Vertex, Ben Mathias from Vertex Ventures came on board. Cisco Investments came on board, which was great. So we had the best investors we could ask for. And everyone around the table clearly understood and goaded us and said, this is a global company. This is a global enterprise company. So we were not an SMB product. So we were doing India enterprise, global SMB. So we had to give up global SMB and India enterprise from a focus perspective and go global to enterprise. So I moved to the US. Karthik, who's one of our top sales guys, moved to Singapore. We had zero customers abroad, no GTM engine, no network, no nothing. And basically he landed in Singapore, I landed in the US, right? So that point in time, I suddenly looked at it and said, we have nothing. We have no momentum. A Series A company has momentum, right? You already operated in the markets that you're now planning to scale in, right? So we had Series A, but we had nothing we had done that earned us our Series A was relevant, valid, or reusable, except the product, right? And great people further out. So that was the point in time wherein, you know, we could have well died, simply because we would not have discovered product market fit in a new market and segment, or we would have realized that our GTM engine is not right, you know. Many things did go wrong, but the fact that we are here meant that maybe one thing went right more than it went wrong. So that was the phase really when I thought it was most stressful for us.
Let's now get under the hood of the product itself. Mm-hmm. And take me through the building blocks of the product.
Absolutely.
And how it evolved, what was the feedback loop.
Excellent.
What were what are do's and don'ts from your journey that Absolutely. Anyone building a product can learn from?
Absolutely. So I think one of the, I don't know, we're lucky or whatever, is that we never pivoted or anything. For us, the problem, underlying problem, never changed, right? So our idea was not, let's build a product and find a market to service it, right? For us, the problem of customer experience was yet unsolved. It is in 2019 still. Everyone's trying to solve it in different ways. So we knew that that's why we're a single product company, right? No matter what we do, how many ways we bell that cat, we will be solving the same problem. So I just generally believe that product comes second, the problem statement comes first, right? If you believe in that problem, you may solve it in 100 different ways, right? If you're feeling cold, you can wear a sweater, you can build a heater, you know, you can build a house with better insulation, right? They're all different products, right? But if you start by saying, I'm going to build a sweater, right? Then you now need to find people and this and that, right? So our problem remained the same. So to that end, there were some building blocks to our product. One, we always said we're an outside-in product, which means we're a customer inwards. We didn't build the product for pains like, hey, brands have a problem with measuring customer experience. We said, how do you want to be treated, right? You get a survey, right? You get some survey and you answer it. Does that tell the brand how you feel, who you are, right? What you value? The answer is no. So we said, look, when someone asks us, you know, when you come back from a holiday and I ask you, Pankaj, I'm going on a holiday. And you say, Vinod, go here, great place. That's an NPS, right? Your willingness to recommend. Now, if I asked you, what weightage will you assign to every experience you had over the last 3 months, from identification, booking, travel, welcome, stay, you know what I'm saying? Wi-Fi in the property, natural beauty, safety, security, staff, food. There are 100 attributes here, right? You cannot humanly assign weightages to each, right? You only know that you will tell me, Vinod, go there for a holiday. So we knew that this is an entire journey. You had a 3-month journey from thinking about your holiday to coming back and recommending it to me. So how can I say that one survey is going to cover this entire experience? So the fundamental building block for us was customer experience is a journey. At any point in time, you are somewhere in that journey, right? So for us, mapping, visualizing that customer journey, engaging the customer at the right touch point in the customer journey, having a conversation that is contextual to where you are, was the first building block for us. The second thing was the fact that a lot of things define you, right? I got a survey from an airline last year, which because I'm a gold flyer and blah, 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 and said, in the end, asked me for my name, age, gender, okay? Now, all of which I know. I don't have a problem with that. It asked me how many flights I had taken last year. The answer to that, I actually don't know. And my assumption was, you're supposed to know because you have access to this information. So in measuring customer experience, transactional data is hugely important. Operational data, demographic data, transactional data, loyalty data, right? Purchase history. So we knew that this experiential journey is incomplete unless we have all your operational data, which sits in other systems, which meant that open APIs and pre-built integrations in third-party systems had to be a fundamental building block of this product. So on day one, I remember Nagendran agreed we wanted a cloud multi-tenant product, open APIs. We knew what were the foundational elements, even stripping away the domain. And the third thing that we were very keen to do, which took us longer to do, is we did not want to be yet another analytics dashboard which gives you pies and graphs and charts, right? We wanted to be a business decision-making tool, which means what? So, and I give this example, which riles a lot of people, is like, you know, we are not in the business of telling you why your dog died. We are in the business of helping you prevent your dog from dying, right? And I love animals. So your analytics have to be predictive, right? You have to be able to tell businesses, not that 70% of the customers left you left because your rates are too high. How does that help you? It should tell you that if you did A, B, and C to this extent, you can improve your retention, you can reduce your churn, you can improve your NPS, you can improve your repeat repurchase rates, right? You should be a part of the forward crystal ball, not a retrospective. So predictive analytics was our third pillar, and we put a lot of focus on that. So today our three pillars, funny enough, are same as 2014, journey-based approach to customer experience, open API platform to ingest operational data and drive predictive and not retrospective analytics on how customer experience can impact business outcomes. That's really a one-liner around cloud sharing.
You know, the other thing I want to understand from you, and I'm like doing deeper dives these days, enterprise startups, because one of the rigors I have seen in enterprise startups, including yours, is this whole focus on making money in that sense, right? Which basically means that, like you mentioned, like you have to solve a real problem for your customers and so on.
Yeah.
How that journey been for you, and any key learnings on that front?
No, absolutely. So if you have to break it down to most objective and less philosophy and more objective nature, it's simple. Who's your buyer in the enterprise? There's only enterprise, right? I don't mean SMB, I mean enterprise. In an enterprise, unless you have someone VP level and above, whose primary job is to buy your software, you don't have a business. And I'll explain that to you, right? So we are a customer experience platform. When we started the company, the number of businesses that had a VP of customer experience, chief customer experience officer, minimal. In fact, one of our customers in the US said 2 years ago they had gone to a customer experience event and the hosts came and told them, hey, by the way, there's one other chief customer experience officer in the audience. You want to go meet him? So there were two in the audience. Everyone else also had interest in customer experience. There were marketers who also did customer experience. You know, there were people in banking who did quality assurance who also did customer experience. There was no C-suite buyer for your product. Fast forward now, the title of Chief Customer Experience Officer, VP Customer Experience, and all the downstream ranks that populate a customer experience team is real. Majority of our buyers are actually C-suite customer experience title owners, right? So one of the things for an enterprise is, unless you know that this is the product for VP of sales, VP of marketing, VP customer experience, CIO, CTO, right? VP of customer success. Unless you have a named buyer who's in the C-suite, you can't sell enterprise. Enterprise deals means 100K and upwards, right? You can't sell a 100K ARR deal to someone for whom the 17th item, line item in his or her KPI is to do this. Then you become a 20K product. So that's my single most objective learning. If you can't determine, now you can call it philosophically persona, ideal customer profile, pain point, all that is great. But if someone's role, title, and designation does not fundamentally involve buying your software, you don't have an enterprise startup, as simple as that. There is more to it, but that's your gated entry threshold or whatever.
Any particular lessons in scaling? And I don't want to get into numbers that are sensitive, mm-hmm. but you give me a sense of that, mm-hmm. both on the revenue as well as user mm-hmm. front. Any particular lesson there?
Yeah, key lesson absolutely. There? You know, I think one of the people who talks about this the best is Girish of Freshworks, right? The word business model is often used, and I think mostly in the wrong way. So business model, 90% of the time, we think it's commercial model, right? If I charge this much, will he buy, will she buy, you know? Or if I charge this much, will my gross margins be intact, all that jazz. That's actually not the business. That's a commercial model, which is a small subset of the business model. What is a business model? A business model is, so let's say, for example, I come in and say, I'm going to set up a panipuri stall, okay? And my panipuri stall basically is a commercial model is 5 rupees for a plate, right? The delivery channel is that cart, right? Target audience is people who are willing to eat on the street outside an IT park because at 5 p.m. when you're coming down, you're slightly hungry, it's not your dinner time, right? Delivery medium is me and two other people who will quickly wash the dishes, you know, and all of that. Now, if the dishes are dirty, people won't come and eat. You know, there's a cycle involved, right? And there's a core product which, number one, it has to be tasty because people come in hungry, right? So if you look at it in a technology perspective, a business model is, what do I advertise, right? How do I market it, obviously? What is the product that I build for that? Who's my audience? How do I deliver it? How do I service it, right? And how do I make sure you come back and buy my product again? Unless all of them are completely in sync, you don't have a scalable, viable business. We found that any point of time, something or the other was giving way. So I'll give you an example. If you're going to we were in SMB earlier. SMB cannot be done if the guy is telling on the phone, hey, please buy my product. Game over. SMB means I'm there, it's on the shelf, people are picking it up and going, like a Freshworks product, right? You've got it, digital discovery, digital fulfillment, digital onboarding, and then there's an assist, maybe there's a phone assist. If you have outbound dialing, an SMB business doesn't work, right? If you have an enterprise product and you expect that it will be digitally fulfilled, and the enterprise CIO, for example, will be okay with everything, click, configure, deploy on your own, then you're wrong. So if you are selling enterprise, your sales may still not be inside sales. It may be in person, right? Mm-hmm. If you're SMB, you can't have field sales. So every one of these pieces needs to align exactly the same. You may not need a Gartner or an analyst relations team for a $10 SMB product. But for an enterprise product, you will need that. If you can't find a way to be relevant in the quadrant or whatever market guide. So each of these pieces you have to choose right. I have seen SMB businesses that are going after Gartner, right? Or you've got 10 inside salespeople, you know, and then the founder is saying, hey, can you connect me to someone in the US? I want to sell my product. That's not scalable, right? Or you've got a field sales team, right? And there's basically just no way to give them a quality lead which they can convert. So that is my big learning. If you haven't threaded all of these pieces together, every time you want to scale, something will break. Not enough leads. Not if enough leads are there, not enough closures. If enough closures are there, churn is too high, right? If that is not happening, NPS is low, which means today, churn will come tomorrow, right? Everything has to align. And thinking that through, that business model through, is at the heart of building a scalable business. And Girish explains this brilliantly when he shows the Freshworks business model. He knows exactly who he's selling to, what he's selling, how he will service, how he will renew, how he will upsell, right? And that is the difference between companies that stutter and do some things right, one bad quarter, one good quarter, and companies that just miraculously seem like they're scaling every month.
This, I think, you're right. This is the most important thing in this product mm-hmm. journey. Like, you invest disproportionate time and energy on thinking through this before you actually think of a business model, revenue, and all.
Spot on. Because mm-hmm. I'll give you a small example. And this is from first-hand experience, right? So suddenly a company has something good, some angel investors come in and put $1 million. Immediately this person says, this is awesome, let me find some guy in the US, you know, it's usually a guy, unfortunately. Oh, he has a Rolodex, right? He's from my industry. I'm paying him $300,000, right? And his cost to company will be $500,000, right? Because he has other expenses. And this guy is going to solve my problems, right? Because he has a quote-unquote Rolodex. Every single friend of mine who's an entrepreneur who's done that, 6 months later has come and said, yeah, it didn't work. Why? Because one guy with a Rolodex does not solve a business model problem. You know?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have to have a demand gen machine that fulfills. He may well connect it to 100 people. You may not have the product for it. You may not have the delivery mechanism for it. Even if you succeed, it's not scalable because there are no 100 people with Rolodexes, right? So hence, business model is super important. If you don't, only the founder can think that through. You can't hire a VP of sales to think through your business model. Your VP of marketing is not going to think through it. You need to know the business model. The VP of sales comes and executes the sales part of the business model. VP of customer success comes and fulfills the CS part of the business model. Marketing person fulfills that. This is the one job other than culture and maybe fundraising, right? That a founder just cannot outsource. Think, articulate your business model, keep tweaking it. That is fine. But only you can do it. Nobody else can do it.
Wow. Very well said. Actually, I can empathize as a rookie entrepreneur, whatever you failed startup.
There are no rookie, there are only entrepreneurs. Every entrepreneur is always learning. So everyone's a rookie in that sense of the word.
No, this is fascinating. On a more final note, you know, in this mm-hmm. conversation, you had a so-called exit,
mm-hmm.
a successful exit, or you know, there's no such, I don't know if there's something called.
I have a problem with the word exit, but we'll come to that after I hear your question.
No, so I want to understand that.
Excellent,
more.
Yeah.
Forget that. I mean, this is a milestone, right, mm-hmm. as an entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
Help me understand some of the key learnings on this front, because a lot of enterprise product companies or enterprise software companies, not everybody says, okay, I want to be a $1 billion revenue company. Mm-hmm. Also, mm-hmm. increasingly in the world, it's becoming
yeah.
very difficult.
Yeah.
So help me understand this period of your life as an entrepreneur and what are some of the key learnings?
Yeah. So I think, look, you have three outcomes for a company, right? Fourth is failure, right? And failure in sense, commercial failure, not otherwise. You know, one is you go public, right? Second is you have a real good, profitable M&A, right? In tech, M&A is probably the number one source of exits. Third is the middling range wherein you're neither acquirable because nobody's paying that kind of money, right? Nor do you have the money or ammo to scale, right? Many companies after 7-8 years reach that point, right? So knowing that these are the options, knowing that IPO is a very, very small option, the genuine answer is that tech M&A is the right outcome for a majority of tech startups. Now, if you look at the history of M&A, any company that reaches 100 million ARR, 150 million ARR, solving a great problem, scaling fast, just has an unbelievable number of M&A options in front of it, right? Some choose to go public, some choose the M&A route. Both are okay. There's nothing wrong with that. At Cisco's own history with AppDynamics, for example, right? Which kind of makes it successful for everyone involved, right? Not just the acquirer, acquiree, employees, everybody, right? Investors, everybody. So I think my big learnings have been that one, you must always be engaged with your strategic partners first from a GTM perspective. The marketing muscle, the channel access, right? The complementary product ecosystem that a strategic partner brings is unsurpassable. There is no product you can build in the world today that exists in isolation, right? Every product you build needs data in from someone, has to push data out to some other platform, right? That's why the whole proliferation of platforms that just do integrations as a service, right? I have 500 integrations, pick and choose. What does that mean? You can't have, no software can exist in isolation, right? So irrespective of what you're building from a software perspective, there is some large tech company in the world that has an adjacent or an overlapping product suite to it, right? Be it communication, collaboration, productivity, project management, whatever, right? Whatever a class you want to look at. So being close to strategic options is something that a founder, again, should invest in right up front, not from an M&A perspective. That's the worst thing you can do for your company. But simply because you can scale so much faster with a strategic partner, especially since so many of these companies have corp dev arms that invest in startups, right? And no, none of them come and invest in you and try to scuttle your growth and acquire you. Like I've never even heard of that happen, right? They generally come in, they will invest money, capital is a good thing, but they give market access, which is what a good investor looks like, right? So my big learning has been that's something you have to engage in, right? We should all obviously not be capped in our ambition. If you want to create a public company, you should. When we talk about why we chose to do what we do, maybe we'll talk about it later. We knew why we were doing this now and not later or whatever, right? But having an awareness and engagement with your strategic ecosystem, I think is very, very important, even if you were to go independent to IPO, right?
What are the signals, Vinod? This is a final questions. Mm-hmm. Like some of the decision-making points are, okay, in one case, should I not do it anymore? Mm-hmm. Which is like, you are a stuck you guy. Yeah. Right? The other is like what you are talking about, and a tech M&A, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are the signals you as an entrepreneur have learned from, or you, you know, watched before you make such a decision?
Excellent. So I think thankfully we did it in good times, right? So if your circumstances are such that you don't have a choice, it's an entirely different set of decision making, right? But for us, I think the first thing was, you know, we were in a very competitive environment, right? So Qualtrics has gotten acquired by SAP, Medallia is just going public, or gone public rather, and there are 5-6 other people, you know? So you're looking at the environment and saying, we know we have a sustainable differentiator. We know what we do better. Do we want to fight it case by case, account by account, customer by customer, lose the odd customer because you're not large enough? Because we're in the enterprise segment now, right? Now we know where our home lies. Or do you want to accelerate this, right? The reason I said exit is the wrong word is because for the team and employees, this is a milestone, right? All of us are going to commit years and years forward looking to building this in the acquirer's, under the acquirer's banner, so to speak, right? So the first thing should be, is this where I want to be for many, many years to come? From a business perspective, from a culture perspective, from a scale perspective, right? So if this is the acquirer who wants, who's able to give me access to all my customers, they have an adjacent product, service, or practice, which just makes 1+1=4, right? That kind of an outcome, right? And culturally, is this the kind of company where you, which you want to be part of, right? So these are some of the decision-making points. We came to a point wherein, when we had this conversation, we said, look, we are ready to scale. We want to hit hyperscale, right? We're getting deals, sometimes we're losing deals. We actually had an open house in the office the day we made the announcement, okay? Which is a surprise to everybody, of course, wherein we facilitated a conversation and said, what are our strategic weaknesses? And so the team said, blah, 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 ABC. When we put all those strategic weaknesses together, I came on video from the US and I said, hey guys, what if I could solve all of these crowdsourced problems that you've told we have, right? Or other, you know, things that inhibit our scale. And I solved it in one shot. And that was the M&A, right? Which is market access, you know, more marketing muscle, right? A greater heft when it came to brand to close the uber large deals. We were very ambitious in our growth, right? Hence, we chose to do an MBA, an M&A, sorry. Because that gave us that market access that we craved, right? And we love the culture that Cisco brings onto the table. It might not be as important if you don't have an option, but if you do, I think that is extremely important because everyone on the team is going to commit many years to being there and you want the culture to be the same as you're used to in your startup.
Before we sign off, you kept using the word culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't, like, I haven't understood what do you mean by that. Excellent. When it comes to building your startup and mm-hmm. where you are. Can you just spend
Absolutely.
A minute on
Absolutely.
That?
So our core set of developers, right, people who are still with the company and the most valuable, have been with us from day one. In fact, day zero. Like, one version of CloudCherry was built even before we started CloudCherry as a company, right? And so they predate me in the company in some ways, right? Because they were working on a hobby project that became CloudCherry, right? So Vijay, one of my co-founders, right, he built a previous version of this in another entity, right? And we started this company. So culture to me is these people who came here. There were months I've blogged about it where we couldn't pay them salary, right? But their belief in the mission, the vision of the company, in the team that's building this company surpasses everything else that is a challenge in nature. The reason I say that is we didn't have a cultural pillar or whatever on the walls. When we were on 12, 15, I think maybe a little older, months old, I think close to 18 months old, we huddled up the 20, 22 people we had in the company and said, okay, let's talk about culture. What is our culture? So the first 20, 22 people, what they, over a 6-7 hour discussion, agreed constituted our culture, that went up on the walls. So instead of starting a company by saying our values are be scrappy, be this, be whatever, and then force everyone to, you know, align themselves around it, after 18 months of being together, close to that, right? What the core team of 20, 22 people believed defined us as a group, basis our natural chemistry, we made that, those our cultural pillars, right? Culture is organic, right? It cannot be copied from somebody else's wall. And it has to be different. If you are the kind of people who say achievement at all costs, win at all costs, that's your culture. It's fine. There's nothing right or wrong about it, right? If you say, you know, I stay humble, if that's your culture, some teams should not be humble, right? That's a fact. You're probably taking on a challenge that nobody in humanity has solved, and being humble is not going to help you solve that problem. So culture has to be organic. It has to be unique to you. It cannot be like coined by the founder. It's the founding team that is going to be around motivating multiple layers of people who come later. That whole team should say, I helped coin that phrase. It was my word that is on that wall because I believe in it. I've practiced it for the last 18 months. So in Cloudcherry, freedom and ownership, if you ask, we have 6 cultural pillars. If you go out and ask, someone will be able to name 5, some 6, some 4. I don't care. But freedom and ownership, every single person on that floor will tell, right? Because they genuinely believe in it, right? That they have the freedom to achieve and do what they want. This is their company, but it comes with the responsibility. That responsibility is called ownership, which means you can't say I did my bit and, you know, it didn't happen, right? So culture is that. It has to be organic, has to be created by the people, cannot start with coin a phrase and then follow it, right? So long as it is real, anything is culture. It is fine. As I said, do not be humble can also be culture. If that is who your team is, you are comfortable in your own skin, and you're probably trying to go to the moon, you know? You can't be humble with that. You need to be insanely audacious and maybe half mad, right? To aim for something that others have not done, right? So that's culture to me.
The one thing I really wanted to understand from you, Vinod, is what people talk about as scars of the journey, the whole entrepreneurial journey itself, right? What it has meant or it means to you as a person, can you...
The journey or the outcome? How do I feel about
the journey and, of course, the outcome. Both of them, right?
I'll split them into two. Sure. Right? The journey part. Journey part, massive learning curve. Because I told you, Venkat, my ex-boss, my very close friend, he showed me what a great entrepreneur looks like. But a great one also shields you from all that is. So I have such immense respect for what all he must have gone through to keep the company capitalized, you know. As I faced it firsthand myself, right? I have now come around to believing, like truly understanding, but that's why I keep saying culture, right? The value of having great people in the company, how you're so, you have to be responsible. People who can work anywhere in the world choose to work with you. So if you can't pay them a month's salary, it's like 25, 26, these young people, they don't have cash balances, right? So that month you don't pay them, someone can't send money home. Someone can't pay their EMI, right? It affects their credit history, right? You can't undo. And you can't assure them that all of this will end up with a unicorn exit and all everyone will be a millionaire. What if 5 years later you don't manage to give them the financial outcome you're supposed to give? So credit history is also bad. Okay. They've had 5 tortured years, right? And you didn't give them the, you know, the pot at the end of the rainbow, right? Knowing that a negative outcome is completely possible makes you value what you have to give people along the journey too. It makes you, it's a very sobering thought. Because I'll be honest, there were days when I'd wake up in the night and be so scared that when this all ends, if this does not land the way it's supposed to land, there'll be literally dozens and dozens of people whose lives, 5 years of whose lives you've wiped out. You can write a book and say, I learned ABC, right? What about some guy who didn't make enough money or a girl who didn't make enough money for 5 years, whose equity means nothing, right? And has gone through half as much stress as you have. So it's a very sobering thought, I'll be honest. In good times, it's great. The outcome's not good. I can only imagine just how heavy it'll sit on your heart. You know, what? That's my journey part. But the outcome part, you know, the way I look at it is I'm a first-time entrepreneur again, right? I come from a family where my father was in the army. My father doesn't even believe in taking a loan, right? When my father left the army, he got his PF, whatever it's called, right? And a year before that, he had bought a house. First time he'd taken a house loan. When he came out, his entire quantum that he got, he paid off the house loan and said, "Meko loan nahi chahiye." So he's the kind of person who believed that you should not have a loan on you, right? Even though he was then stuck with zero cash balance because all the money went, right? Otherwise, you'll keep the money and pay off EMI. So I don't come from a business background, right? I don't know what leverage means. I don't know what debt means, right? So for me, from an outcome perspective, I have even investors, financial investors, professional investors who put in money, I don't believe it's the risk of venture. I feel morally obligated to do my best, ideally return money, right? Or at least do my best, right? So be it my friends who funded the company and kept me afloat month on month, be it semi-professional, like, you know, angel investors, even all the way to professional institutional investors, it may sound a little naive, I believe I have a moral obligation to return that money, right? I don't think it's equity, so risk is yours, so, you know, too bad I tried my best. If this had not landed the way it's supposed to, I would be personally guilty. I'll be honest with you. So for us to end in a place wherein the angel investors, the investors came along the way, institutions, all of them made money. The people who spent the journey with me will obviously make money, right? They're getting good jobs, roles in a very large company, right? And most importantly, the company and the vision will now get turbocharged, right? We'll close 100 times more business than we would have in natural course. When I put all of that together, right, it seems like it's an unbelievably fulfilling journey for me.
Does it change you as a person? We are talking of scars of the journey. It takes time to heal and so on, right? I mean, no matter what the outcome is, right? It could have been other way as well.
Yeah.
But has it changed you as a person?
I generally think I'm way more responsible now. Like, even in my previous startup where, you know, I was running sales and huge amount of responsibility. Ultimately, you know, the head that wears the crown, they say, right? So at some levels for me, you could zone off saying, you know, you've done your bit. Not when you're the founder of the company, right? Or co-founder or CEO, whatever, right? So it's changed me from a perspective, it's newfound respect for what responsibility means, right? Newfound respect for just how great people can be. I take people experiences very personally. So if you walk up one fine day and leave me for a higher paying job, I will take it personally. I can't not take it personally. That's how I am, right? But thankfully, fundamentally, I've remained the same person. I value human relationships. I believe in ethics, right? I believe in transparency. And the one skill that I totally did not have that I've probably gotten better with and still not good at is giving and receiving feedback. And the number one job as a CEO or a leader of an organization or a team is to give feedback and to receive feedback. And it's probably the hardest human activity to do. If I have to look you in the eye and tell you that you are truly incompetent at your role, right? That's soul crushing, right? I have to tell you that you think you're a great marketer and I have to tell you, no, you're actually not, right? Or whatever, right? You're not the right person for this role or whatever. So that's the part that I think I've gotten better at, right? But thankfully, the things I believed in, I believe in them stronger now. And I hope I'm more responsible and, you know, more accountable for my actions than I was maybe 5 years ago. So.
Fascinating, you know.
Thank you.
I also feel like this is a conversation we have to keep alive for a long time to come. So for now, let's call this a milestone.
Awesome.
And wrap it up. And Godspeed with whatever lies ahead of you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it.
Pleasure talking to you.